I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 40 days now since the fall of Baghdad, and the U.S. is busy once again reorganizing its organization there. In the meantime, Iraqis are taking matters into their own hands. Literally. They are digging through the mass graves, sifting the dirt with their fingers in search of lost relatives. International human rights groups despair over this. They see the evidence of war crimes quickly disappearing as it's carried off in plastic bags or scattered back on the ground. Now, the Americans say they don't have the resources to oversee a more orderly exhuming of the mass graves, and that they already have their hands full just trying to bring a measure of security to the country. Connection listeners, we're talking about reconstructing not just the mechanics of a nation, but the psychology of a people. Can an army charged with managing security also oversee emotional reconstruction? Should it have to? And how can Iraqis be persuaded to move from the anger and frustration of oppression and then war to justice and forgiveness? Unless there's a plan, a promise from the U.S. occupiers of just what they will do in Iraq, and when, and with whom, and for how long. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me on the program today is Colonel Garland Williams, Senior Army Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. I think that's Institute of Peace, have I got that right?
Yes, yes you do.
I do. Sorry, missing a little word here. And Garland Williams' research also concentrates on infrastructure building and post-conflict operations. Garland, you've done this yourself in Sarajevo, in Kosovo, in Albania. What's going wrong in Iraq?
Well, what's going wrong, that's a big question. You need to take a look at how long we've actually been in there trying to do the reconstruction. A lot of the problems that we have before going in is we didn't know what we didn't know. Mm-hmm. This regime has been going on for a long time, and we haven't had a lot of access into Iraq to find out, for example, the physical infrastructure, how devastated it has been just from lack of maintenance since the first Gulf War.
But let's talk about, if we can, the issues that seem to be stealing the headlines away from even electricity and power and infrastructure at this point, and that is the lawlessness that exists in the country, the search for relatives in the mass graves. It seems that what is of greatest importance to Iraqis isn't necessarily priorities for the American occupying forces.
That may be true. The security piece is a difficult problem. What we have there right now as far as police on the ground are 1,800 military police, going to rise to 4,000. But that's not a big enough force to be able to rule something, say, the size of the state of California. Now, we've also got some Iraqis that have been former police officers that have volunteered to come back and work. About 7,000 of the original 40,000 have come back to work, but there's a problem there. Their offices were looted. They really don't have any place to work out of, so they have no place to call home, and they're not getting paid. That's something that Mr. Garner and also Mr. Bremer have to face about paying. Army units are not really trained in the security piece, except for the military police. We can hold and occupy an area fairly well, but as far as doing the evidence of a crime, stopping looting, that is not really in our training area, except for the concentrated people of the military police. A lot of criticisms have come from not having enough forces there. You can take that from two different directions. The first direction is what Secretary Rumsfeld has talked about, a fast and lethal, quick war. And then the other direction is, okay, you fought the war, you've won it quickly, you've done it well, but you don't have enough forces on the ground to provide the security. Mm-hmm. Whose role is that? Is that the United States? Sure, because we're the occupying power right now. But you got to look at, the war's only been over really for 5 weeks. If you didn't expect looting, then you might have had your head in the sand a little bit. If you didn't expect some infrastructure degradation from years of neglect, again, we might have had our head in the sand. Now, there's been a lot of criticism also about the planning effort of what the Pentagon calls the Phase 4 operations. I'm not sure if that criticism is really justified. They did take a look at what post-conflict would be. But again, if you don't know exactly what the state is before you get in there, the plan only survives the first contact. And now we're having to readjust the plan.
But again, from being in places like this that, let's take something really simple. Communication. It's going to be a problem. Maybe the phones won't work. And so why would it necessarily not have been in the planning books to say, you know what, we're going to need a quick, fast, small cell phone network. So at least those of us who are involved in the reorganization are going to be able to talk to each other.
I think that's a valid criticism. And they have issued a contract. Now, one of the problems with the contracts that USAID has issued is that they require security before the contractors can come in and do their work. For example, Bechtel has having a problem with getting in there. The company that they've hired temporarily out of France to do the GSM network has having a problem getting in there because the security is not there in its full force. So I don't think these problems were overlooked. Mm-hmm. But again, we are real early in the process.
Yeah, I want to hear you talk a little bit more about that because I was in Baghdad a month ago. A month ago, everybody was wringing their hands over the shock and the surprise of all the looting. And I don't know how quick, you know, a force like the U.S. Army in Baghdad can, you know, reevaluate and say, we have a big problem here. We need to move on this now. Even today, we open our morning newspaper and it's, you know, are we going to shoot the looters? Are we just going to jail them for a little bit longer? I would have thought that sort of thing could be moved on more quickly. What happens behind the scenes? What am I missing?
Well, U.S. forces, they operate under rules of engagement, as the article you probably read this morning stated. The rules of engagement is usually based on self-protection and force protection. You know, we're not going to go out and fire at a looter. That's just not a good thing to do, in that we're trying to promote a more peaceful environment. For us to go out and shoot a looter on site, that I think would add to the violence. And I think the article's got it wrong. I don't think the idea was we're going to go shoot looters. I think that was a comment made by Paul Bremer that was taken out of context. I think what he was trying to say is that we've got to be more tough on looters. Instead of holding them for 48 hours, we're going to hold them for 21 days and make it where the experience is so bad for them, they're not going to go back to it. Now, if I was a looter, if I was a person that had lost everything, the tendency to go loot and get stuff for my family is high. Granted. But we have to find a situation in which the looters have something else to look forward to. We need to move the companies and the contractors in there to start setting up the basic infrastructure. Now, you mentioned earlier that power may not be their priority, but really it is. Mm-hmm. If you have water, if you have power, you can at least do the basic necessities in which to live. And the follow-on governance can happen on a more gradual basis. But if you don't have power, if you don't have water, you know, they're going to look over their shoulder and say, am I better off than when I was, you know, 8 weeks ago under the Hussein regime? Many people, maybe 20-year-olds and under, who really haven't seen anything else in their life, may agree that the Hussein regime, although it was oppressive, they were better off than what we have right now. But it's going to get better. And that's the message that we have to get across to them. Getting that message across is hard when you don't have access to TVs, to radios, to working newspapers.
But that could also be something that could have been anticipated. Right, that some form of communicating, some form of plan was or would be something extremely important to the Iraqis. What is the, you know, the war crimes trial system going to be? That might give them some kind of sense of what's ahead. What are we working on today? That on a local radio station might give them something to talk about other than exchanging rumors. Was that something that was missed?
I don't think it was missed. I think the problem we run into, the thing they wanted were basic services immediately, and that's what we promised. But when we got into it and the looting continued, we got into some electric power grids, for example, that the only person that knew how that power grid worked was the manager. And none of the power grids were the same. And there wasn't an overall plan of all the power grids throughout Baghdad, for example. So the engineers that are part of the reconstruction team are having to piece this together. If you don't have power, many times you're not going to have good radio communication. Now, when I was in Bosnia and Kosovo, they did an awful lot by generators. But that was in a more stable situation where you didn't have remnants of the regime trying to destabilize whatever comms exists. Water, again, same thing. They're going in there and they're trying to find out what the water system is, and they're finding no plans. And the people that ran these things have left. So you're starting from scratch. You're not starting from a standard system. They're having to make it up as they go, and that's why it's taken longer than what was anticipated. Did we anticipate having to communicate our message to the Iraqis? Sure. I mean, that is what our psychological operations units do as a business, and they're working hard on that. We did it before the war with the leaflets. But it's real hard to get out a message of reconstruction and revitalization through a piece of paper. You've got to be able to talk to them. As far as communication verbally, they've started town hall meetings to be able to take the complaints, to be able to set people up back into jobs. But it's going to take time. And that's something that the biggest message to the Iraqi people is we've got to get across it. It's going to take some time. It's not going to happen instantaneously. When you compare this with, say, Bosnia, Kosovo, or Afghanistan, the Iraqi infrastructure, it was so far beyond or so far much more developed than those countries, and the Iraqi people had a higher expectation. I think that's why we're getting such a bigger backlash now than we did, say, in the other three operations.
What's the difference, as you see it, between the issue of the mass graves in Bosnia, the importance of getting the international human rights groups in there to do the cataloging of bodies, both for the benefit of the people and for the sort of legal reasons, and what we're seeing now in Iraq? Because it seems such a contrast.
I think the contrast is the media play. In Bosnia, if you remember, when they found the mass graves at Srebrenica, for example, it had huge media play and had a big buildup. The mass graves we found in Iraq, in my opinion, were a surprise, at least to the outside world. We didn't have quite the same access in Iraq as we did the Balkans, and we're having to react more than to plan for a mass grave. Now, and also the scope. I think the scope of what you see in Iraq is so much bigger than what we saw in Bosnia. I've seen estimates up to 20,000 people in the mass graves in Iraq, and we can't, and in many varied locations, and we can't secure them all just because we don't have the people on the ground. We don't have the advantage of DNA testing to be able to identify these people. And also, the distance between when many of these people went missing in Iraq is greater than what the distance was in Bosnia, so we're having a harder time to even figure out where people went missing. In the identification process, they're going by old identification cards that may have been found on a body or a wound that they thought or clothes that they were last seen in. It's not a smooth process.
I would have thought, though, that with reports even prior to the war of 200,000 to 300,000 people missing, that could also have been planned for.
Now, look at the media censorship and the media blackout really coming out of Iraq. We did not have a lot of access. I mean, even the media, even yourself, probably didn't have unfettered access throughout Baghdad where you wanted to go until the regime was taken down.
A lot of it was supposition, but a lot of it, you know, came from people who had escaped the country and knew the details. And
sure.
We'll pick that up when we come back after our break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, can an occupying force charged with managing security also oversee emotional reconstruction, and should it have to? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Another suicide bomber attack in the Gaza Strip today is the latest in a series of attacks affecting hopes for the U.S.-backed peace plan. For more on that story, go to our website, WBUR.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're taking a look at reconstruction in Iraq this hour, and not just the infrastructure reconstruction, but all the issues of security and mass graves and the psychological aspects that seem to be so preoccupying for the people there at this time. With me on the program today, Colonel Garland Williams, Senior Army Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and author of the forthcoming book, Post-Conflict Reconstruction, on the critical path to long-term peace. We're joined on the line now by Peter Ford, Christian Science Monitor correspondent. He's in Baghdad. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I read a story that you wrote late last week about a man running the morgue in Baghdad, saying that they're averaging something like a dozen bodies a day, people who are shot in the sort of lawless street life that is Baghdad today.
Yes, and I haven't been to see him in the last couple of days, but there's nothing that I've seen on the streets to suggest it's likely to have gone down significantly. The Americans and the Iraqi police are doing their best to restore law and order, but there's an enormous amount of crime directed now towards individuals. I think in the first few days and weeks of the looting, it was more public buildings. People were stripping them of everything that wasn't bolted down. Now those are empty. Those sorts of thieves are turning on people just driving their cars in the streets and forcing them at gunpoint to get out and driving their cars away. It's the sort of thing that, frankly, one sees or one hears of several times a day in the town. A lot of people, most people, are afraid to go out after dark, even though curfew doesn't start till 11. And I think the Americans need more men on the ground, apart from anything else, to get this under control. And they are bringing more men into Baghdad.
It also seems, Peter, that when the United States does get tough and people end up in firefights with the U.S. soldiers, that they're all making the claims that they're innocent victims. And I wonder from a sort of practical public relations point of view, how the Americans are doing there today. Are they able to get their point across? Or are they increasingly being criticized both by the looters and the people who are being looted?
Well, they are increasingly being criticized by ordinary, straightforward, law-abiding Iraqi citizens, partly because they had expected law and order to be under control before now, and partly for a range of other reasons. I mean, simply things like electricity, which had appeared to be getting better in Baghdad up until the weekend. Today, however, I've been around many parts of the city, and I found very few that had had any electricity at all for the last 24 hours. Now, that may be because they've had to take the power system down while they try to mend the national power grid. The big problem in Baghdad, of course, is that it doesn't produce enough electricity for itself. It takes it from the north and the south, which have excess electricity, but they can't get the power grid up. That's partly because the national grid was never very robust in the first place, even before the war, mainly because a lot of it was destroyed during the war, and partly now because remnants of the former regime are attacking the power grid. They're trying to blow up pylons and this sort of thing, which is making life extremely difficult. But for ordinary Iraqis in the capital, they are more and more frustrated by the lack of simple everyday services.
And so what are they saying to you? Are they saying that, as you said at the beginning, the Americans simply need to get more people in there to bring about law and order? Are they more suspicious than that?
Well, on the question of law and order, most people say that the Americans should get tough. And I think we are beginning to see that. Although, as you say, soldiers are extremely reluctant to shoot looters. In fact, they don't have orders to shoot looters. Their orders to shoot only if their lives are threatened. Most Iraqis, I think, would not regret it or think it was a poor decision if the Americans were tougher on looters. But the ones who say that they were just innocent victims, well, of course, one never knows exactly the circumstances of incidents, especially if they occur late at night. But I know that I myself saw a man brought into hospital in the middle of Thursday night, the early hours of Thursday morning, whose friends and relatives were saying that he was perfectly innocent, doing nothing but sitting around. The American soldier I found later who shot him said that the guy had raised a gun on him. The doctors who operated on him to save his life said that he had the sort of scars on his chest which prisoners in Iraqi jail often inflict upon themselves, wounds they inflict upon themselves as a sort of initiation rite. The doctors who saved his life were quite convinced that this was a fact.
Peter, just one more question, and it comes again from a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor, and that is, you're writing that that there's a suspicion that a lot of the shooting in Baghdad is becoming revenge killing. As people go to the mass graves and they find a brother or a father, then they're taking that frustration out on a former Ba'ath Party official. Is that just supposition at this point? Is there evidence that that part of it's getting worse? What can you tell us?
Well, it's hard to pin down, and we certainly have not seen the sort of wave of mass revenge killings and inter-ethnic killings that some people before the war had forecast and feared. But one does hear quite often of what appear to be revenge killings. For example, just the other day, one of the popular singers in Iraq, a man who appeared regularly on Iraqi television singing songs of praise to Saddam Hussein, was walking down the street. Somebody walked up to him and put three bullets in his head. Now, that doesn't seem to be regular crime. That doesn't seem to be simple thievery. Given his prominence, that would appear to be a straightforward revenge killing. And I think that this sort of thing is going to continue. It will probably get worse if people feel that they can get away with it. And at the moment, most people in the streets of Baghdad think they can get away with quite a lot.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Peter Ford is a correspondent with Christian Science Monitor, and he was on the line live from Baghdad. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. It's been almost 40 days since the first U.S. tanks rolled into the city of Baghdad, and that city fell, as we recall, quite rapidly. And taking a look at how the reconstruction has gone over that period of time, whether or not the priorities are what they should be. For example, does an occupying force have the responsibility to tend to the emotional needs of that country's people? As I mentioned earlier in the program, Colonel Garland Williams is joining us from a studio in Washington. He's Senior Army Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. Colonel Williams, you had a chance to listen to sort of the latest news from the street in Baghdad with Peter there. Any surprises in what he's saying?
I don't think so. The revenge killing, we should have anticipated. We saw that also in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. Maybe not to the extent that we have it. But also, there's not a city in the Balkans that's 5 million people. So you have to look at the scope of the problem to see if it is worse or better than somewhere else we've seen. Revenge killing is going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen just because they don't have a normal idea of what a calm, peaceful society is. They have been ruled by a violent dictator for decades, and the transition to something calmer and something that is driven less by power is going to take a little bit of time to get it across. It's not going to happen overnight. Now, people calling for more men. I mean, there are 15,000 soldiers en route to Iraq now from Germany, and they've been on the hook to come down there for a long time. When you take a look at where the U.S. military is right now and really how many people is available to put on the ground, you know, we only have 13 divisions, 3 in the Marines and 10 in the Army. And when you start pulling those off for missions in Afghanistan, the Balkans, mission possibly in Korea, you know, we have a division in Korea, you start to get down to the numbers where we are almost getting stretched to the point where we can't do anymore. This is something that I think that NATO could possibly help with, or the UN could possibly help with. And I know some countries are signing up to bring in forces as far as peacekeepers and as far as security. That is something that I hope the administration is working on hard, and I believe they are. And I believe they're making inroads, especially with Secretary Powell's trip last week.
1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. We have on the line with us now Dr. Zuhair Humadi. He's an Iraqi human rights activist and co-founder of Mafqud.org. That's a website tracking missing people in Iraq. Dr. Zuhair, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You were in Iraq, in Baghdad, just a few weeks ago, am I right?
Yes, sir.
And you've had a chance to listen to the conversation. What would you add about, in your view, what may be missing here?
I think many of the problems stems from the conflict of liberator or occupier. Many of the U.S. officials at the beginning were reluctant to use the word occupier. They just wanted to use liberator. To me, I think it's both liberation and occupation. And liberation because the Iraqi people were liberated from Saddam Hussein, and millions of Iraqis are very happy about that. But at the same time, the U.S. is an occupier power and has responsibility to at least bring, you know, order and security to the Iraqi people. So if we can, I think even U.S. officials, they have, I think, moved into the second mode. You know, they are an occupier, and they are moving forward to bring more troops, more law and order. However, there are very symbolic things that they should have done. You know, I don't know why they did not appoint a chief of police for Baghdad. It's a symbolic, you know, but as Peter Ford said that there are about 7,000
Iraqi policemen.
Yes. So why don't they appoint a police chief for Baghdad? You know, because the Iraqis maybe will go and complain to him or relate to him more than a general or a colonel sitting in the U.S. headquarters.
I know that there have been a number of criticisms of just basic lack of communications, a shortage of translators, for example, in terms of getting that conversation underway. Colonel Williams, the identity crisis that Dr. Hamadi is talking about, liberator, occupier, have you seen that?
Oh, I think he's absolutely right. I believe that the Pentagon and the administration thought we were going to be received much more warmly than we were. And I think initially we were received warmly. But we do have an obligation as an occupation force. The occupation force should have to provide about two different things. They have to provide internal security, and they also have to provide external security. Internal security, which we've talked about considerably, and the external security is so that there's not a power void in Iraq that the neighbors around Iraq may want to take advantage of. I believe that the doctor has a good point about appointing a police commissioner, but who's that going to be? I mean, you've got to go through the debathinization process. You've got to make sure that the person that you appoint as the police commissioner is somebody you can live with for a long time. I know we've brought in the former police commissioner from the New York City area to work with the Ministry of Police, but that's very recent. So you got to go through the debathinization process and get somebody you can live with. We made a mistake in the Balkans about dealing with the first person that we knew could speak English. And we've learned a lesson from that. And I think it's going to take a little more time to find the right person that we want in there for a long term.
I just want to comment, you know, beside the identity crisis between occupier and liberator, a lot of Iraqis, they think, you know, because the sudden surrender of Baghdad was stunning, you know. And a lot of people think, not only in Iraq, but in the Arab world, that there is a conspiracy. You know, there is a deal between Saddam Hussein and the U.S., what happened to Saddam? You know, people are wondering, you know, why were he arrested or where did he go? So there is a problem, and they are afraid that maybe Saddam Hussein he will make a comeback. And that's why people are reluctant to show emotions of support to the liberation.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Potsdam, New York. Richard's on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm quite impressed with your distinguished commentators, especially the professor, because I think there's a central question here, which is everybody's sort of talking around it.
Okay.
It has to do with the nature of authority and how it is perceived by the Americans and by the Iraqis. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer in North Africa, and I've been an anthropologist for many years, and I've become aware that Arab culture understands authority. Of course, the Arab cultures are diverse. There are many Arab cultures. But in general, they view authority as something externally imposed, and that one does not...
What do you mean externally imposed?
Well,
not from...
Yeah. In cultural terms, there's a very broad generalization made about cultures. Some cultures internalize authority so that you become your own authority. You obey the rules because it's built into you internally. And American culture is one of those cultures. Most Western European cultures are. But the Arab culture is of the other kind, where authority is not built into the individual, that it is always imposed by an external figure, usually a policeman on the street or some symbolic figure of authority, whether in the family or in the community, in the government. And they're used to this, and they find it very odd when we come in and occupy, conquer them and then occupy them, and then do not act strongly to repress them. To repress them from the looting, and to repress them from the score.
Is repress the word you mean, or protect?
No, repress. And I use that in sort of Freudian terms.
Okay, let's hear from Zuhair Hamadi on this.
Keep people's actions, keep them behaving by being present as an authority. Simply the threat of force will do it.
All right.
You don't have to shoot anybody.
Hang on a sec, Richard. Let's hear from Zuhair on this.
I think the gentleman has you know, a good point. You know, it is true that Arab culture look to authority, but I think that the Iraqis wanted somebody to protect them from the old regime. You know, as somebody said, I think either Peter or Mr. Williams, that ex-Baathists were walking the street, nothing happened to them. What's going on? You know. So they, the authority came with the U.S., but they did not see the result of authority. They did not see the people were arrested who were ex-Baathists, or even saying that the people who were involved in the mass killing. You know, we are talking about maybe a quarter of the people who are really missing in Iraq. You know, they did not say that. A court will be established to bring those people to justice. So, you know, the people are still, you know, figuring out what's going on.
Right. I think this explains the score settling that's going on.
Yes.
One could have anticipated the looting and the score settling both, given the nature of their previous regime and the nature of their attitude toward authority. Suddenly the pressure is off and people go wild, and there's nobody to stop them. And then once they get through the looting phase, then they go after the previous enemies, the previous people who repressed them. And I think this will go on for a while until such a time as we make it quite clear on the streets that people cannot do this. I understand how complex it is with the electric grid being down and with our shortage of people on the ground. But I think the administration failed to anticipate a crucial matter here, and I think they're now having to pay the piper. They're going to have to bring in more, a lot more people than they've got now, and really think it through.
All right, Richard, I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Richard speaks from the experience of working with the Peace Corps in Tunisia. And Connection listeners, you could go through a great long list of countries that have dealt with certain aspects of what Iraqis are facing now: Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia, Kosovo, Chile, Haiti, Somalia, Afghanistan. Where are the lessons to be found in the nations that have dealt with issues like this before? We'll pick that up when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by UR listeners and by AstraZeneca, a worldwide pharmaceutical company committed to pushing the boundaries of science to meet the world's medical needs. AstraZeneca, life-inspiring ideas. By Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, conversation about rebuilding Iraq, but not just the country, also the psyche of the people there. With me on the program, Dr. Zuhair Hamadi. He is Iraqi human rights activist and co-founder of Mafqud.org. That's an organization that catalogs those missing in Baghdad. Colonel Garland Williams is also with us. He's a senior army fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. And Colonel Williams, let me start with you if I can, because there are, as I mentioned just prior to the break, so many nations to look at for examples of what might go wrong and what needs to be addressed. And I'm wondering, as you look back over the history of broken nations, whether or not there ought to have been a little bit more consideration of countries like Cambodia or Rwanda or Chile, where so many people were killed by the state itself prior to a war, rather than just necessarily looking at perhaps Afghanistan or Bosnia.
I think we did. I don't think we looked at post-conflict Iraq in a vacuum. But the caller earlier made a great point about authoritarian rule. We are trying to change the mindset of a society from somebody that was repressed to somebody that can have rule and basic ministry support by self-determination. That is a big mind change. For example, as we're standing up the ministries right now, the person that's running the organization is looking to the lieutenant that's standing there for permission to give salaries or to give raises. Mm-hmm. The lieutenant's having to throw that back into his face and say, you do it. It is now your job. You don't have to call up the government to get permission. You have the permission. But that's a mindset that has to be changed. Now, we can look at all the cases back in history that the United States or the UN has gone into and probably pull lessons, but each one is different. each one is diverse. Each one has different parameters in which we have to take advantage of and take into account. I think the self-determination for Iraq is probably the key. We have to give it in their mindset that they have the power to determine what they want to do next, not only for the total government, but also in the individual ministries and organizations.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Marinette, Wisconsin. Dave's on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering, now with the lack of troops in the country and the still the unruliness that's happening there, do you think, even though the administration is coming out and saying we don't want to stay there, we want to, everything is here for the Iraqi people, but don't you think changing the Iraqi people's mindset by letting chaos happen for such a long period of time that they would invite us to stay for a very long period of time and want us to stay, and then eventually the administration coming out and saying, look, we're going to stay. There's just too much lawlessness happening here. We have to stay here. And I'll take your comment off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dave. Zuhair, certainly when I was in Baghdad, I heard people saying, we want the Americans here forever. And then I heard other people saying, you know, get these guys out of here as quickly as possible because they're the big part of the problem. How do you see it?
I think the Iraqi political spectrum, you know, from A to Z, all of them, they think that the U.S. should stay there, you know, for a minimum time to get things in order and then leave. But at the same time, they are not seeing any progress toward setting up an Iraqi interim authority or an Iraqi government, you know. And I don't think you can accomplish security, or you cannot have security without at least from the Iraqi point of view, an Iraqi government authority. So there is a problem in that.
But to the point that Colonel Williams made, I mean, what is it going to take to persuade Iraqis to take charge, to take control of their own affairs? I mean, that would seem to indicate, as Dave's suggesting, a long, long presence.
I don't think Iraq is, or the Iraqis are, like Afghanistan or some other country. I mean, you have a very educated people. You have infrastructure. Maybe it is broken in many respects, but it's there. You know, you have a lot of Iraqis are capable of taking things in their own hand. But you have to have a political management at the beginning to get things moving and get things forward. And I think whatever they appoint, you know, like they brought the police commissioner from New York. At the same time, they should put an Iraqi police commander with him, so that people will see that they are doing it in parallel. You know, it is important, I think, and symbolic.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. To Toronto next. Mary's on the line. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a couple of points to make. I'll try and make them as quickly as possible. The first is how angry I am at these generalizations about Arab society. Certainly the Canadian and European and British papers have been filled with the people in Basra and that, where the imams did bring, the people went to the imams and they did bring back peace. They did try to bring in a civil quiet and were sabotaged by the American authorities. And secondly, it's Colonel Williams, I think. I'm not too sure. I hope I don't have his name wrong. But I seem to be just an apologist for Bush and his cabinet in the Pentagon. Canadian papers have been filled with quotes by a national security advisor who was questioned by a reporter about the fact that months and months and months had gone into the setting up of the war part of the war. And then what about, was there anything done about the peace part of the war? And she said, what do you mean? President Bush spent a whole hour on that. What's your problem? And as for the other point the colonel made about there's no American soldiers, well, that's because Mr. Rumsfeld on the leaner, meaner army put all, shall we say, the nation-building people, such as people with police background or any of that, into the reserves.
Mary, Colonel Williams is with us on the program. Do you have a question for him?
Sorry. Well, that's, my point is that it seems to me you're not you're covering up for what's really happened. It's been a debacle. Just last week, I'm reading in The Guardian about the number of junior officers, shall we say, at the Pentagon, who went hat in hand to Tommy Franks and that, saying, we haven't done any planning for anything after the peace breaks out, and they were told to shut up or basically be shot. The rest of the world is hearing all these reports, is seeing these things, is seeing the, as I say,
okay, Mary, let's let the colonel have a chance to speak back to you.
Okay, for planning, had they been planning since September 12th when President Bush came out with the Axis of Evil? Not for the Phase 4 operation, but they have been planning at least since December. And that's probably as good as you're going to get right now, because the first three phases are going to take the majority of their time to figure out what the military solution is to taking down the regime. Now, I got to take a little bit of issue with your comment about Secretary Rumsfeld. He didn't put all those forces in the reserves. This has been done since the Vietnam era, when we decided that if we're going to go to war, we have to mobilize the will of the country. And so you're right. Civil affairs, military police, engineers, they are in the reserves. But take a look and see where those reserves have been for the past almost 2 years, since September 11th. We have reservists that are going that are on their second year of mobilization and will finish up their second year and will have to be demobilized according to law. The other engineers and civil affairs are in other places. They're not sitting back in their armories in their towns in the United States. They have been activated or mobilized. I'm not being an apologist. What I argue in my book is that if we're going to go into various occupations and various operations, we got to plan for the aftermath. We have to go in full hog with forces and also money, if they're available. Now, does that mean U.S. only? Probably not if we continue along this path. But there needs to be some kind of a coalition to go in there to deal with after the war. If we don't have the idea of going in there after the war, then maybe we shouldn't do the war in the first place. But that is something that does go into the thinking of the Pentagon. I'm not trying to be apologist for their planning. I do think planning should have happened a lot earlier, and I do think that the Army and the military and the civilian aspect should have gotten together sooner. But that's something we have to learn.
Zuhair, what's the level of patience, of tolerance for these lessons to be learned on the ground day to day, in your view?
Well, I will give you an example. I am in constant. Hello.
Yes, you're with us. Go ahead.
I can give you an example. I am in constant contact with my family in Baghdad. About 3 weeks ago, I spoke with my sister. She said, "Zuhair, we really don't care about electricity. We don't care about the water. We are so happy that Saddam is gone." You know, this past Saturday, I spoke with him. She said, "Look, you know, the summer is coming. The temperature is getting 40 degrees centigrade, and it's becoming very tough, you know, to survive in this, especially water and electricity." So I think the when the summer starts coming, you know, and it's already there, I think people will be much more frustrated and. Problems will arise.
And Colonel Williams, there is something that I want to draw from Mary's tone, if not her question, and that is the whole credibility of the United States in this type of reconstruction work. Because unless I'm mistaken, much of the work that you've done in the Balkans has been as a part of a larger international effort. And in this particular case, Americans said pretty well, you know, we can handle this. We don't want the UN in right away. We don't want a bunch of other nations in right away. Yes, it may happen, but I mean, it would seem to me that the credibility of the United States at this point is certainly something that's being talked about right around the world.
Certainly. Credibility for, you know, we're the biggest gorilla in town, and therefore the Iraqis should look to us for peace, security, and quick rebuilding. One thing that we've got to look at is how fast can the international community respond post-conflict? Can the international community mobilize their resources, for example, the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank? How fast can they have donor conferences and get contractors in there to start this reconstruction? I don't think the United States has precluded any of that. In fact, the World Bank is anxious to get in there and do the assessment and start the donor process once the security situation stabilizes. The things that I have done in the Balkans have been, you're right, under NATO command. And one of the frustrations there was that as a military officer, I couldn't do anything that did not have anything to do with a military mission. It's the way the funding rules are written up by NATO and also the mandate given to me by the United States. But in the absence of anybody else to do it, there is a void. And we're seeing it again in Iraq. And until we can get that security situation and the civilian contractors in there, it's going to continue.
Well, I mean, should the, you made this point right at the very beginning of the program that rules of engagement are constraining the Americans in Iraq right now, the same way you were constrained by military rules in the Balkans. Should there be a different form of rules of engagement for that moment between the end of a conflict and the establishment of peace? Because if the circumstances that we're looking at today are a result of that, surely that's something that could change.
Well, when you look at rules of engagement, it's very specific and it's written very simply so that there is no mistake about what a soldier can do should he encounter some kind of an action. Rules of engagement will always center around the individual protection of the soldier. And they will always center around bending over backwards not to kill or not to injure the civilian, to go as far as possible before having to shoot something that inflict damage. That will always be that way. There will never be an indiscriminate shooting of looters. That will just never happen in the American Army. But also, I mean, I can't read you the rules of engagement. They're classified for many reasons so that a citizen won't know what a soldier's going to do. So there is that element of surprise. But we're not going to change the rules of engagement in between conflict, immediate post-conflict, and stabilization. They're still going to be based around self-protection and self-protection of the civilian. I mean, that we're not here to kill all the civilians on the street. We're there to protect them as much as possible and to keep them from hurting each other.
Let me just get a last quick word from Zuhair. So where are we, liberator or occupier?
I think both. But I think the lifting of the sanction with the introduction of the resolution to the Security Council, I think it's an important element because that will legitimize the occupation. And from there, you can move forward.
Zuhair, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Zuhair Hamadi is an Iraqi human rights activist, co-founder of Mafqud.org. Colonel Garland Williams, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Colonel Williams is Senior Army Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and author of the forthcoming book, Post-Conflict Reconstruction on the Critical Path to Long-Term Peace. And earlier in the program, we had a conversation with Peter Ford, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based currently in Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Hour 2 of The Connection is up next at 11. The poetry of Pulitzer Prize winner Charles Simic.